सत्त्वमस्याभिलक्ष्यम् एकं नित्यं विमलमचलं सर्वदिशाक्षिभूतं पापातीतं त्रिगुणरहितं सद्गुरुं तं नमामि।
Okay. Where best do you draw the line between sankalpa and prasada buddhi? When it is right to give up or stop persevering for a dharmic goal, such as having a child, marrying someone, accepting the prarabdha, non-attachment of the desire with grace. Okay. I'm going to replace the word sankalpa with like a strong desire. And when you have a strong desire, as long as it's within Dharma, you know, if it's not within Dharma, then you need to practice some sort of discipline. You know, it's not within Dharma, it's not good for you, it's not healthy, it's hurtful for you in the long run, etc. And even though there's a desire there, you want to try to break that or funnel it another way, right? But say the desire is fine, it's a dharmic desire, there's nothing wrong with it at all, except that it's a strong desire and you're more or less trying to be, you know, free of desire. But with karma yoga is helpful for that interim, for that interim period where all that is here is Ishvara. The karta, the doer is Ishvara, what is being done is Ishvara, the karmapala is Ishvara, it's like Brahmarpana and Brahmahavi, everything is Ishvara. You know, and because of the fullness of myself, which is not just a thought, but it's a reality, you know, I really am perfectly fine just being with what I have. I am perfectly fine. And if a desire rises up, I just take it as the prarabdha karma. The karma, we say, you know, manifests in three ways. The prarabdha karma. Either someone is pulling you into a situation because of their need or their desire. Or like, for instance, offering you a job or I'm needing you to go somewhere with them or whatever it happens to be. Somebody else is initiating that karma. Or the universe itself is creating a situation where you find yourself enclosed by that particular karma, not caused by anybody, caused by the universe or the situation. And then the third one is swechaya, means it comes out of my own psyche as a desire. So for a jnani, if you have a desire, you just take it as the prarabdha karma and see what happens with it, see what Bhagavan does with it. That desire is there, and so something wants to manifest in terms of your karma, and so you're fine, you're with it. But you go with it, and just see how it unfolds, because it's not something foreign to you, it's not something foreign to the situation, it's just an unfoldment, and you have the energy for that. Like when Swamiji all of a sudden got kind of pulled into this aim for seva, which he was in for 20 years or so, quite some time. He was involved in this all India movement aim for seva, for service, trying to help all of the tribals and all of the children to get educated and all. He did so much work. He couldn't believe. He thought he was totally done. He was just going to go to Rishikesh and live a sadhu life and let students come and just teach. And that was it. He's taught enough, done everything enough. He just wanted to go to Rishikesh and be there. And that's what he thought. But then he was pulled in to this aim for seva through the, some of his devotees who really wanted this, and also a lot of other types of people. It's kind of a big thing. They wanted him to do it. And he found himself saying yes. So he was pulled into that for some 20 years. And really, when you look at his whole life, it was so necessary to give the Hinduism itself, the religion itself, the culture, kind of a, some more strength to be able to handle the, to be able to hold the Shastra, the Vedic Shastra. You have to have Hindus, people who are Dharmanishtas within that culture, to hold the Dharma, you know, or it's not there, right? It resides in the people. And so he did all of that work, which he had not expected. And he said it was so surprising, he couldn't believe it. We thought, what's he doing? And there he was, totally engaged, and it made sense, actually. So I would say that, say, as a karma yogi, and when your mind is still working things out and you still have desires, the reason that Bhagavan is telling Arjuna, you stay in your field for this reason, so that you can, there's nothing wrong with that desire, it's a strong desire, you want to go in that direction, but you have that prasada buddhi. You make the commitment, you take the actions to make that happen, and then you accept the results as with that prasada buddhi. And Bhagavan might say no, and then you can try again. Okay, this one's no, but let me do, change a few things, and let me try again, you know? Because there's no adharma there at all. There's a desire, a yearning. And so then you try again, and either the door opens or it doesn't, and then you may try again, and by the third time, if it's a third no, usually you're just worn out, and you say, okay. But, or maybe you're not. But there's, the thing is that there's no problem there, because of the, if the karma yoga attitude is there. And it actually stops you from repressing, you know, who you are and what the unfoldment of your own psyche and the unfoldment of your own life. It's not this type of thing, okay, if a desire comes, you can't do it. I'm saying you cannot do it. That's not it at all. It's the attitude with which we do it and how we accept the results. You know, if you accept the results as that prasada buddhi, then it'll be all as well. You know. So I wouldn't thwart your desires. It could just be thwarting your prarabdha karma. Why thwart them? And unless it's hurtful in some way. You know, use the energy. Use your energy in the direction that it's going. If that's something you really want, why not use that energy and, you know, let it fuel your life, you know? So that's actually really, it's really an important question, because sometimes the feeling is that, oh, okay, from this point on, no more raga dvesha, no more likes and dislikes. That really can't happen in any healthy way unless you're kind of resolved into your own ananda. You know? Then there's no reason for it to happen. Then when these desires come, you just say, well, okay, you know, that's fine. It's your prarabdha. But when you're still kind of maturing and you have some desires, you don't know whether it's prarabdha or not, it really doesn't matter. If you have that karma yoga buddhi, you should stay in your life and work through these things. It's actually really important for your health, for you to stay as a kind of a healthy, vibrant person. You know? So. We'll be talking about this a lot, actually, because this is the whole thing that Krishna had to convince Arjuna of this. So there's a lot of discussion about this. Why do we have to go through this pain? What does it give us? Except from knowledge. And why don't we have it? And why don't we have knowledge from the start? Well, okay, why do we go through this pain? Well, if we have to have a reason, since pain is there, there are some some reasons, I think. I think that happiness is like a vacation and pain is a sadhana. That's kind of how I look at it. Because I'm not really talking about physical pain. Physical pain is another type of sadhana, where if I have physical pain and then a chronic pain, it's a sadhana, and to learn how to be with that. You can say, well, that came from my... You can believe that came from my prarabdha, or it came from toxins in the environment, or whatever it is. I don't know that for sure, but I know that I have this chronic pain that I have to deal with. And so learning how to live with that in a way where I can still value my life and use my body to whatever extent I can use it, you know, and do what needs to be done, taking care of this body in ways that I wish I didn't have to. You know, that's a whole transition that I have to go through. Swamiji, when he was really starting to get older, of course, when you're older, you kind of expect you may have to, but you're never really ready for it. You know, because all of a sudden, nothing works. He lost one eye and then could barely see out of the other. His hearing was so bad, became so bad. Here's his teacher. His hearing became so bad that we had to put little earphones in his ears and talk into the earphone. And he had this range. You know, the vocal cords have a certain... I mean, hearing, the ears have a certain range where the sound can get in. So for most people, they have a range. And if I'm talking to you, I'm talking high or low, you can hear. But for him, he had this little tiny range. And there's only a couple of people that could talk. I like that. So I'm going to take the big Yamanda. I think she had the range. She hit right in there. So whenever she talked, he could hear her. If I talked, he couldn't hear a thing. Not one thing. So I had to always talk to this little mic that went to earphones, you know. And then he could hear barely. So that's the eyes are gone. Almost gone, and so they had to. He was still teaching, so they would print out on big pieces of paper, you know, great big letters of the Bhasha. You know, each letter was like this big. And then he lost his voice, his singing voice, his beautiful voice, you know. And then he was not able to stand up by himself. Mm-hmm. He said, "What did he say? It's like this is." Something I'm under 24-hour care. He laughingly said, like in hospice, you know. It's 24-hour, you know. I'm under 24-hour care. Because he could no longer really do anything by himself. But when you were sitting there with him, even though he couldn't hear hardly at all, he could barely see. When I was completely blind, he could barely see. Even in the class, he said he could only see the first two rows in a big kind of way. Okay. And then he was coughing and choking all of the time, and he couldn't hear, so he couldn't hear, he couldn't see. He could barely talk, and he was choking all the time. He couldn't get up, he couldn't stand up. But everybody still wanted to see him, so we're all... And he would just sit there, you know, because he couldn't really move without somebody helping him to move, you know, helping him get up and all that. So, you know, he would just... sit there, and people would come and put the earphones on. We'd put the earphones on him, and then we'd speak into the thing. And it was like there was nothing wrong. We didn't think, oh, Swamiji can't see, he can't hear, you know. He can barely speak, he's coughing all the time. We don't think there's something wrong, because we're still with him, and we're still communicating, and we're having the conversation we wanted to have, you know. And also, he's not really acting like there's something wrong, you know. And he's just taking for granted this, in the end, rather quick, but actually a slow degradation of all of his capacities, you know. So how to be such a beautiful person and so present to everybody and taking all the questions seriously and running, people come with what was Aim for Seva. They have meetings, Aim for Seva meetings, and meetings about the Ayurvedic Center and all of these things, and he would be doing his correspondence with a body that was just as about as dysfunctional as you can possibly get and still be alive. Yeah. But, you know, you never heard him. He was just normal. He was just normal in this broken down upadhi, you know. Once he said, it's hard not for you not to be able to sing. Because he had such a very beautiful, beautiful voice, you know. He used to sing all the time. He used to just enjoy singing by himself, you know, and listening to some of the great recordings and singing along with it and writing songs and all that. So when it comes to accepting the breaking down body, you know, that takes so much patience, you know, so much care, so much love, so much giving over to Ishvara and just being here with what you have. That's what he would do. You just be here with what I have and do whatever work I can do with what I have. Amazing. You know? And he did it. It went on for a couple of years. And just got, I mean, it went on for 5 or 6 years, actually, but that last year, so it was really, really incredible. And I learned so much from Swamiji that last period of time. And even his mind, he had such a brilliant mind with this Medha Shakti. So Medha Shakti means this incredible memory. And he would say things like, you know, I don't have the same memory that I used to. Just say, matter of fact. And then one time I left and I said, I know Swamiji, I know you, but it's still like 100 times better than mine. Because he had so much, you know. He noticed a little. Well, none of us noticed it. He would know. Anyway, that's an incredible challenge, you know. But say just the things in life. So when you think about that, that's extreme, right? And there's so many things in life that just don't go our way, you know. That's how life is. Whether you're jnani or you have karma yogi or you're samsari, you don't always get what you want. So what? Swamiji's really good at saying that. You know, so what? It's just what, this is what is happening. So what? It doesn't matter. In terms of your ananda, in terms of your wholeness, in terms of Ishvara, really, it doesn't matter at all. You know? So that's that beauty with that karma yoga. Buddhi and to have jnanam. I think the realization that everything that you seek in life is really only yourself. Because you don't seek the thing, whatever thing it is, whether, I don't care if it's a person or a child or a marriage or a job or an object of some sort. It's not the thing that you want. You want the ananda, the wholeness that you believe that thing will bring to you, you know. And that's what you want, you know. So if there are certain things that are kind of archetypal needs, like marriage and children, but there's also the sannyasi archetype, you know. So there's things that are, and also culturally acceptable. You know, the wife and child, the husband, wife, and the little children in a nice little house. So I'm just saying, with a white picket fence and kind of a nice couple of cars in the driveway and this kind of whatever's the standard, cultural standard, you know, or having a certain amount of money so that you can be respected because you're making an income. But, you know, these things hopefully are quick to go. I want children only because that's my prarabdha. That's who I am. That's why I want children. Not because of the Joneses over here who have 3 kids. I want it because that desire is arising in me. And then Bhagavan gives that to me. Okay, and if it doesn't, okay, what can I do? You know, I want to be married, but if nobody comes, if that doesn't open up for me, that's what it is. What I'm saying, though, that's at the beginning, because and as you kind of relax, it's your prarabdha that opens up to you, and that's what you want. In the end, what you want? I want this. Right? What, yeah, I want this. Yeah, I want this. Yeah, this is fine. That's the alam buddhi. Oh, this is good. Whatever it is. It's Ishvara. This is what I'm getting. That's fine. That's good. I don't have this idea that this isn't good. I need this, this, and this. That comes because of projecting my ananda on an imaginary situation that I believe, just because of cultural whatnot, that or that archetypal drive, that's going to do it for me. But at some point, that's not how I feel at all. I am happy to just be with what I have. And the other thing that Swamiji will always say, what you have is yours. You know, what is in your karma, you will have that in the prarabdha karma. What's not in the prarabdha karma, you won't have. So, good. Don't worry. All is well. But I like that, because I like it kind of, because Swamiji said it, and I also believe that for my own life. So, again, does pain give us emotional pain, especially, so I'm not talking about physical pain now. Emotional pain is like something inside holding up its hand and telling me there's something here for me to learn, especially for a mumukshu. If you have emotional pain, you know, I have to learn how to be with that pain in a way that is healing, you know, or to see what is my part in causing that pain. Sometimes it also has to do with my own growth, because the way that I'm behaving in the world or behaving with others may cause some sort of rejection or pushing away of me in even subtle forms. And if I'll feel the pain of that, and then I take pain as a sadhana, really, like what is it that I really want? What do I really need here? What am I asking for and not getting? And just being, totally being with yourself and talking to the little ones inside. So when you have pain, you know that something, some sort of work needs to be done. We don't have knowledge from the start, because if we had knowledge, there wouldn't be any ignorance. Right? When you gain knowledge, the ajnanam is removed. Otherwise, ajnanam, ignorance, we look at ignorance as beginningless. It doesn't have a prior condition. It's the only thing that's like that. It doesn't have a prior condition, but it has an end. And the end is only knowledge. And so you don't start out with knowledge. If you start out with knowledge you already know, then ignorance isn't going to come and knock you on the head. Bonk. You know, it's not going to happen. Because ignorance can't arise from knowledge. So what's it going to arise from? So we say, because of the very nature of the creation, and you can kind of use the dream drishtanta illustration to understand this also, that the individual in the dream is naturally has self-ignorance, because the upadis, the conditioning agents, are limited, right? And so they're not omniscient. Like if you're the whole upadi, you're not identified with anything in it, you have all knowledge, all of the knowledge that exists for that particular projection. So that's why you get to understand to be a little, you're like a little Ishwara, Ulpa Ishwara, in reference to your dream and your imagination. And you can go back and forth from being, taking a form in the imagination and experiencing the imagination or the dream from within the dream, or you can be free of identification with a form and experience the whole dream as your being. Right? So the one where you're just experiencing, you're identified with the individual, then there's a limitation there, because the mind's limited. So that limited mind enjoys or manifests consciousness. Right? But that limited mind is then part of the subtle body that's pervading this physical body, which is inert, so to speak, within the category of maya, mithya. It's inert. There's really nothing inert, because it's mithya, and the only thing really there is consciousness within that. From the standpoint of the dream, we say doesn't reflect consciousness, this doesn't reflect consciousness, I reflect consciousness. But this body doesn't, because when I leave the body, it's just a dead body. It's not able to, it doesn't reflect anything. It just goes back in dust. See what I mean? So that nantha, the ignorance is a natural product of the creation from the standpoint of the jivas within the creation, just because of the upadi, the limitations of the upadi. Whereas if there is not an identification with an upadhi or Ishwara, and then it's omniscience, there's no ignorance at all. These need a bit of unfoldment, but I'm just telling you what it is. It has to all be talked about a little bit more. If every being here on earth would gain moksha and stop rebirthing, wouldn't it be a very, very empty here? Yeah. Then what? He goes, then what? Okay. Then what? The thing is they say that the jivas are infinite. And infinite minus one is what? Infinite. So that's the answer to that. It's not going to happen. But then you could think of things like, well, what if a whole planet dies and there's no planet here to for the jivas to be born on? The planet itself is gone. There's no jivas, there's no animals, there's no mosquitoes, there's no humans, there's no anything. You know, then what? Well, then you would have to say, your next thing to say is, well, do you think that this Earth, this one planet Earth, and this infinite creation is the only planet that has life? That's one thing to look at. And if you say yes, and say you're right, this is the only planet in the infinite universe that has life, that can have jivas, which is highly unlikely, but say that's the case, then what has to happen is that all of the jivas will occupy the other lokas, or either be in all of the other lokas that are available, more subtle lokas that are available, or they'll be in unmanifest condition in what is similar to deep sleep until the pralaya, and we get to start again, having made a mess this time. The earth having died this time, we have failed, so to speak. You know, we have to kind of accept that failure. We'll all be in unmanifest condition for millions and millions of years, and when the earth comes back again, the kalpa, you know, the creation cyclical, and it comes back again, then the karmas will, if you were to think like that, I don't really think like that, but I think the opportunities for life on every level is as infinite as the jivas are. I thank you for your comments on veganism today. It reminded me of an issue I am having at home regarding family gatherings with meals, which happen often in my family. My mom goes to a lot of effort to make a nice vegetarian dish for me, so I will feel welcome and join them for the meal. However, the more I study Vedanta, the more sensitive I am becoming to eating at a table with dead animals on it. I feel torn between respecting my family and participating in the meal versus respecting my values and perhaps choosing to join them after they have eaten. Can you share some wisdom and perhaps personal experience with this? Thank you. I think it's the best thing. Is you can't... I don't think it would be at all helpful to, in any way, to making your, helping your parents or family members become vegetarian or vegan by not participating in their family gatherings because you're a vegan and they're not. It's not psychologically a very, very happy thing to do that. They'll feel rejected and they'll feel like you're fanatical. And for them to even become a vegan or vegetarian, they could become that for health reasons, which sometimes people really do, for just because they study and they realize that for their health, they should actually be a vegan, not even a vegetarian. They should be vegan, for the health. If you start really studying that, or they're ecologically conscious and they know that eating meat and dairy is probably the worst thing we can do for climate change, so they've been abreast of that, and so for that reason they might become vegetarian, or they have woken up to having compassion for all of the plight of all of the animals, you know. That's also, these are all wonderful reasons, you know, to become vegan. So there's like three major, major important reasons to do that. But each person has to wake up to at least one of those reasons, which is not a given. It's Not yet. Being vegetarian or being vegan is growing really pretty quickly, actually. It's all over vegan restaurants or vegan choices. Not even vegetarian choices. It's been for us in the States. It's been there in California. California, New York, in Boston. It's been there for a long, long time, but not vegan. But now gluten-free and vegan, these things, are you can almost find it at any restaurant, at least in California. So that's a big thing, you know, even whole restaurants that are vegan. So it is making its way. And so I think it's better to be vegan or vegetarian wherever you are in your own unfoldment now. And be with your parents and thank your mom so much for cooking a vegan meal for you so that you can really be with the family. You know? And then enjoy being with your family and don't even bring it up, you know, unless they ask you. Just be there, be a family member, be happy to see everybody, and, you know, participate. That's what I would do. And then just the fact that their child is vegan will if there's no rejection or pushing away or criticism on your part, but you're just part of the family, they will become interested on their own and ask you, and they'll probably say something like, "Oh, honey, I can't even imagine living without my meat." But there's a consciousness that's brewing in there, which is a good thing, you know. So I think that's the best way to go. It's a hard thing. And then you have to... Oh, well, let me tell you this other little story. Swamiji had a really hard time with people eating meat. He just couldn't believe it. I mean, as a Brahmin, you know, ooh, it's like... So, it's just a big ooh. And so, when I was at the ashram for those years in the States, in Sailorsburg, and Sailorsburg is on the East Coast, and my sister and her family lived on the East Coast, and my brother and his family lived on the East Coast. My sister was like 3 hours north in Rochester, and my brother was like an hour and 15 minutes directly west. And so whenever I would come to the ashram to be with Swamiji, they would always come. In fact, usually I would fly to Rochester and my sister, and sometimes with Kristen, they would drive down, and we would all drive down together, and they would stay for a few days with me. Sometimes the other kids also. So that we would stay there for a few days, and when they knew we were coming, sometimes we would drive down from Rochester over to Delano, where my brother lived, and see them, and then they would come the next day. We'd just have a family day with them, then they would all come the next day. And they would all be waiting in line to see Swamiji and talk to Swamiji. And because they had known Swamiji for many, many years, and he's very kind of important, like their guru without being mumukshus, you know. My sister was a little bit more, because they had so much love for him and respect, and they took his advice and all of that. And they loved Vedanta and all of that for me, you know. And they thought it was beautiful, but they didn't have that need, so to speak, for themselves. But they loved Swamiji so much, and he loved them too. We're looking at years, like from 1984 until when he just passed away. That's a long time. So all the kids have now, they're all adults, and he was with them all the way. So they would always, every twice a year, come over, and Swamiji would always, you know, when I was up talking to him about this or that, he would give me like $150 or something and said, "Take them out." Always he wanted me, because he was afraid they didn't really like the Indian food or whatever, and he wanted to give something, so he wanted me to take them out to a restaurant, okay, so that we could have a nice meal together. And he loved that. Okay, so we always did. I said, "Swamiji wants us to go, he's treating us to a meal." So we would always go and have a nice meal at one of these few, there's not that many restaurants, there are a few, have a nice meal. And then I would come back and I said, "Don't tell Swamiji we, you know, we went to the restaurant, we had a really nice meal." And then he could never help himself with this. He said, "What did they eat?" And I would say, because we'd had this conversation 50 times, I would say, Swamiji, you promised that you wouldn't ask that. And he goes, oh, I know, I'm sorry. What can I tell you about? You know, my sister had a big, juicy hamburger with French fries, and my brother had a rare steak. You'd like everybody to be a vegetarian, to kind of know that, and you have sympathy and pain for the animals and all of that, but you know, you also have to be with your family, and they're not ready to know that yet. It's not available. Margaret Mead, a famous anthropologist, said, it is easier to change a person's religion than their diet. And I think it's true. The diet is very, very important, people, for their nurturing, for their social life. You know, you're giving up a lot, in that way. You're not really. I mean, because if you can have a good time among people who are smoking and drinking and eating this and that, then you're not really giving up anything. You're just not doing that. But they don't even notice, because you're not saying, oh, sorry, I don't drink. Or, oh, no, I don't smoke. You just don't smoke. And you just don't drink. It's a non-issue. You just don't eat meat. It's not, oh, I'm sorry, I don't eat meat. You just don't eat meat. You eat what is there to eat. See what I mean? And then nobody really notices, because you're not looking around kind of worried about and complaining about it. Then they don't have a problem. Yeah. Which is kind of nice to know. How can we support more of the collective, Dharma? How can I help somebody who is on the adharmic side? I think, actually, we were talking about little footprints and big footprints and all of that. I think we support the collective Dharma by being dharmic, you know. And I think that's a huge support, because you think that who you are and your care for people and love for people that's real, and the way that you behave, that other people don't, that it doesn't affect every other people. But you know what? It really does. It really does affect people, you know. And you don't have to convert people. You know, it doesn't work. This conversion thing doesn't work. If they want to know something, they'll come and ask you about it, you know. So also, like, the work you do, can the work that you do, whatever it is, be done in such a way that it's helpful to people just by your attitude? Your attitude itself. And I don't really care what the work is, you know. The attitude, your attitude, you know, changes yourself and people, you know. So I wouldn't underestimate the effect you have on others, even though in your mind you're not doing anything, you know. Like Swamiji used to say, I don't remember quite how he said it, but what it amounted to was this: I don't notice anything special about myself at all. And that's because he is that, you know. And since you are that, you're not really doing anything, you're just being yourself. And you probably can notice in yourself, as you outgrow certain tendencies or certain issues or temper tantrums or whatever it happens to be, as those things drop off of you, they're just simply not there for you to even notice. They're gone. In fact, you probably had the experience of one day just realizing, wow, I used to be like that. I don't even remember when that dropped off. It's just that there comes a time when it doesn't come anymore. But as far as you're concerned, you're just being yourself. And yourself actually never had any problems and never will have any problems, so there's never been any change in you. It's just at all. But it's just that these issues slowly drop off and resolve just because of your value system or because of growing up or because of the influence of other people, you know? It's really interesting that way, you know? So. Okay. How come Advaita Vedanta is not seen as a philosophy or religion, as it has that aspect of God and is so philosophical, since religions often also say that they are a way of seeing things, a way of seeing things is the real truth, that their way of seeing things is the real truth? Well, actually, you know, like within academics or within the textbooks that are available, like the Hindu Shuddarshanas, the six philosophical systems, Advaita is viewed as a philosophical system. Even though traditionally we don't view it as a philosophical system, we view it as a pramana, as a means of knowledge. But then even when it's kind of categorized along with the Sankhya Yoga, that's two, Sankhya and Yoga. And then the Vaisheshikas and the Nyayayikas, that's another two. And then the Mimamsa and the Vedanta, that makes the six. And then there's some what we call Darshanas or philosophical systems that don't accept the Vedas, like Buddhism called Bauda, or the Charvakas, or the Jains, the Jaina. So these three are also philosophical systems. So when we look at kind of an overview of the Indian spirituality, which is also philosophical, you can categorize it like that. This is Advaita Vedanta is put in there, and within Advaita Vedanta is categorized as Advaita Vedanta, Vishishta Vedanta, Vishishta Vedanta, and Dvaita Vedanta, and all of these things. This is the Bahushaka, this tree, all these leaves and branches. So it is categorized as a religion, but it won't categorize itself as a religion. It will look at the Vedas, as the scripture, what we call the Sanatana Dharma. They don't even see Hinduism as a religion. What they say about that is that the group of people, Hindus, grew up along the Sindhu River. And these Westerners came along, probably down from Russia, I think, and they couldn't pronounce the Sindhu. They pronounced Sindhu as Hindu. So really, Hindu is just those who grew up along the Sindhu River, and they had this what we call Sanatana Dharma, which is a beginningless Dharma of the Vedas. And so that Vedic culture that contained them, they were viewed within, traditionally and within that culture, as something which has come down from beginningless time. And in that Vedic culture, which the Vedas are the scriptures of that, and it was all just oral, also oral tradition. The whole Vedas were oral. It's way later that they were actually written, you know. So within that Vedic culture, there was the Karma Kanda, you know, the first portion of the Vedas and the second portion of the Vedas and all of the Dharma, the Dharma Shastra, as an additional shastra, you know, and Jyotisha, all of these shastras that were all part of their culture. So they saw it as their, these words religion didn't even exist, actually. It was the Sanatana Dharma, which they were a part of, which they lived within that, you know. And so, but then, with academics and whatnot, we start categorizing, putting things together, into sets. We put things into sets. And so within the Hinduism, if you want to categorize the religions, there are different types of religions where they have different types of worship. And those religions can have different philosophical systems. But within the Vedic system, we look at these philosophical systems as they've come into being. Most of them, all of them in fact, are of human origin, like from the Buddha, Sankhya also, has an origin. I can't remember who that person is, but they have come from human origin, except for the Mimamsa and the Vedanta, because the Mimamsakas and the Vedantins are very tied to the Vedas. their scripture is the Vedas, so there's no human origin there. Where the others are, like for instance the Sankhya and the Yoga, they rely on practice and logic to prove their position, even though they accept the vision of the Vedas, but they rely on logic. So there's all of this. So a lot of things happen over the centuries. These come into being, you know, over the centuries. And yes, both religions and spiritual teachings, however you want to say that, and clearly now for what we know, so Sankhya Yoga, Buddhism, the various types of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, there's many types of Buddhism, and the Advaita Vedanta, these ones that were from Taoism, you know, they have a sense of having truth, wisdom, you know. And then to really understand in any meaningful way what the differences and similarities are and what they actually mean by wisdom and with the different traditions, you have to spend time really understanding those traditions. And then you can see, like, I've spent a lot, because I've taught it for many years and I have the background of Vedanta, I've spent a lot of time with Sankhya and Yoga, and also with different, with classical Buddhism. And so you can see with these particular traditions that are always all coming out of the same cultural heritage, that they're actually answering and working with kind of the same ground of being in a way, the same myth, or the same beliefs, and trying to get to the truth of all of that and gain liberation from that cultural worldview. And the cultural worldview includes moksha. It includes reincarnation. It includes liberation. It includes dharma and adharma. Yeah. Transmigration, all of these things are the same for all of them. The guru-sisha relationship is there for all of them, though viewed differently. See what I mean? So even with reincarnation, what they mean by the jiva or the soul, some translate, and you'll see in English books translated as soul, what they mean by the jiva. What are the components of the jiva? Is there really such a thing as a jiva? All of these are at issue, but the thing is that they're all talking about whether or not this particular thing is there. Whereas in the West, we don't have that same cultural container. It's a different one. And so then we're all the kind of the philosophies and religions that are within that cultural container, you know, are talking about the same things in a different way. Like say, if you look at Christianity, there's broad strokes. You can go Catholicism and Protestantism, but now there's hundreds of different sects of Protestants, and there's several different, meaningfully different sects of Catholicism, you know. But they're all, whether Protestant or Catholic or all of these different things, they are all talking about the same set of beliefs. So, anyway. How would you describe what Vedanta is to someone who asks, who doesn't know anything about it? Well, I don't know. I'm not very forthcoming myself. So if somebody were to ask me, I would probably throw the question back a little bit first to find out what it is they really want to know. Like, I'd say, what have you heard about it, or what was your how do you even know about Vedanta? I would want to find out a lot more about what they know and where they are with it and what they've heard, and you know, and then I would tell them in probably a really kind of a simple way, you know, that it just deals, that Vedanta really deals with kind of the underlying reality of this creation and God, if there is one, and the individual. Usually say the individual and the creation and God, if there is a God. Because that's going to be a question. And if there is that God, what is it? And what is the underlying reality of that? And who are you? And all of that. You know, and so I'd say it's kind of a traditional, and very ancient traditional method of teaching to make you see the truth of yourself. Something like that. Simple, and not get into it, because most people, I'll just say that's enough. I don't need that sort of thing, honey. That's what my mom said. So, please don't talk anymore. What happens after moksha? Where do we really go? Okay, that's a... give you a one-sentence answer, but we really have to work up to really seeing the meaningfulness of that. First of all, nothing... yourself never goes anywhere, right? Because for you, there's no time and there's no space, so there's never going to be a loss of yourself. But what there will be a loss of are things that are born of ignorance, that they're a product of ignorance. So when you gain knowledge and you still are your prarabdha is still running its course and will drop off when the body drops, you will still have this body, the mind, the sense organs, but the jiva srishti, all of the projections of the jiva upon Ishvara are more or less withdrawn, right? And if they're not withdrawn, they're mitya, right? And so you're basically just Ishvara, but you have still the body, mind, sense organs, and you're still living out your prarabdha. And what that reminds me of is in the Mundaka Upanishad, I think it's at the end of maybe the second section, I think. There's three or four sections in it. Near the end of the verse before last of the second section. They talk about why that the devotees always go to the Mahatma to ask for, you know, my child is sick, Swamiji, will he get well? Will my child get well? Or I need to send my children to college and we have no money. Can we get the money? So, you know, just asking for whatever is their worry or whatever their situation. Because if the Swami says yes, you'll be all right. So there's this, will my son be all right, Swamiji? And Swamiji thinks about it for a minute and goes, your son will be fine, don't worry. I've seen Swamiji do this. Your son will be fine, don't worry. You know, your husband will get the job. It'll be fine, you know. So once I asked Swamiji, but Swamiji, how do you know, you know? And what if he won't be fine? And Swamiji, what he said, it just comes to me clearly. And I said, what if it doesn't come to you clearly that you don't know, or it doesn't, it's not a good thing that comes, you know? Then I said, what do you say then? And he said, "He said, let's pray and see. I'll pray for it and see." That's what he says. And then I said, how do you pray? In any case, like if somebody asks, will my husband get the job, or will my child be okay? You know, so I said, how do you pray? And he said, I just visualize it. Which really is so profound, really. I see it, I let it come, I see it, you know. But that is how the unconscious and the psyche works. It works in images, actually. And since he doesn't have any, or a wise person, not just Swamiji, but a wise person doesn't really have any raga dvesha, you know, you don't have an agenda. And so let's just see what it is, what comes, is Ishvara. So that's what that particular verse is very clearly about. And that is kind of well known in the culture. And so everyone in the culture, Hindu, in the culture, has a guru. There's the family guru, you know, and kind of the family, your family has a guru, but their guru had a guru. So it all goes kind of back in the same lineage. But that guru is a really important part of the family, you know, because of quite, not because they're mumukshus, they're usually not mumukshus, hardly anybody's a mumukshu, you know. That's rare to be a mumukshu. But they need that wise person and somebody to rely on for dharma and for guidance, and when they want prayers or some assurances, that type of thing, that the guru is a very, very important person in that way. You don't ever want their child to become a guru to take sannyasa or something. They want their children to get married and have kids so they can have grandchildren. But so my children shouldn't become gurus themselves. But the guru is held in very high esteem. There aren't a lot of mumukshus, So if that we have a community of this size of people who really are really serious mumukshus interested, that's a huge blessing. It's not meant to be a big popular thing. It's not. It's kind of in chess, it's the end game, It means that you've just, it's like apples and oranges. It's like you're in samsara, and that is what's real for you. And there's a lot of in the Vedas, a lot given to help with that, to allow you to lead a dharmic life and to have shanti, to be a good person and to fulfill your desires in a meaningful way. And so it's very beautiful, actually. It gives you a guidance where you can have the maximum amount of relative happiness in this creation. It's a guide for the Swamiji calls it a manual for the world, But the mumukshu is the one who's recognized something else. It's really wants to know the truth about what is going on and the truth of myself and wants to know God, really what it is, who God is. And wants that relationship. All of these things are, it's like Swamiji's often called it, like you're going up, say a river is going down toward the ocean and you're turning around and trying to go back up to the source, And that's kind of what it is. So it's not something that, like when I thought when I was young that I had gotten this, like this jewel, and I brought it back to all of my friends and I thought, you're all going to be so ecstatic to have this. It's just not true, You have it. You have it. And then maybe somebody that you know also. Anyway, it's a beautiful thing, but it's not meant to be, a popular, necessarily popular. So you just cherish it for what it is. And it's all mumukshu, let all the mumukshus be cherished. Because it's a huge punya. To even have that, according to traditionally, to have that desire. It's not ordinary at all. Even have that desire. So it's something very special. Yeah, so. Okay.
Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam. Nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmanevyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini vesho yamsho parahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kashchittu prabhat bhavet Asato ma satkamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Mrityor ma amritam gamaya avashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om.